Good evening, and thanks for joining us. This is RMU Radio, and you're listening to Sports Takeover with Matt and Chris. Let's get started with Super Bowl 53. The NFL season has officially concluded, and the Patriots are once again Super Bowl champions. Chris, thoughts and reactions from Super Bowl 53?
Well, I, for one, thought it was a very good competitive game. I know most people in the world, NFL circuit, wherever you see it, didn't really care for the game too much. I enjoy a good defensive battle. That's exactly what we saw here. The final score was New England 13, Los Angeles 3. Really, I mean, the score was close, but it didn't really seem like the Rams ever had much of a chance at all in this game. Some quick stats to run down for you through the offensive side. Tom Brady, 21 for 35, 262 yards, one interception. Nothing fantastic. Jared Goff, even less stellar, 19 for 38, 229 yards, one interception. So passing wasn't that effective. Running the ball was only effective for the Patriots. Sonny Michel had 18 rushes for 94 yards and the lone touchdown in the game. Todd Gurley on the other side of the ball only had 10 rushes for 35 yards. He seemed to be the most explosive player, I thought, on the Rams, and they did not use him quite nearly enough, in my opinion.
I would argue Cooks was more explosive than Gurley was. He had 8 catches for 120 yards. I thought he was the bright point of the Rams' offense. You talked about the score and the lack of offensive production. It was the lowest scoring Super Bowl ever, beating out Miami and Washington with a combined total of 21. This one had 16, so a 5-point difference there. 3-0 at halftime, which is the lowest half ever. The second lowest ever. The Steelers once had a 2-0 lead over the Vikings at halftime of a Super Bowl.
So, that's good stuff.
After the third quarter, that was the lowest game, lowest scoring game. The Rams were the second team in the history of the Super Bowl to not score a touchdown in the big game. All they could manage was a field goal. Just not a lot going on. Julian Edelman won Super Bowl MVP with 10 receptions for 141 yards. He was one of the bright spots. You mentioned Sony Michel was also a bright spot for the New England offense, but the defense really stole the show. You said you thought it was a pretty entertaining game. I'm one of the ones that didn't think it was so entertaining.
I didn't say entertaining.
Okay.
I enjoyed it, but I understand why it was not entertaining.
Right. I like defensive football. I'm all for defensive football, but I like seeing big plays, sacks, interceptions, some sort of turnover, literally anything. And I felt like all I watched was an offense try to run into a defense that, although both defenses played well, I didn't think there were many players that were spectacular. Gilmore was solid for the Patriots. He had 3 pass breakups, a forced fumble, and of course the interception in the red zone. Dante Hightower had a pass breakup, 2 tackles for loss, and 2 sacks. So, I mean, there was some playmaking, but there wasn't a lot of playmaking defensively, at least in a flashy kind of way. I mean, of course, it was solid all around. For the Rams' offense, 27 of their 60 plays went for 0 or negative yards.
Oh, man.
So, obviously, the Patriots stacked up pretty well against them. Aaron Donald only got to Tom Brady 1 time, not for a sack. He just only got there 1 time. Just not a lot to brag about in this game. Defense was great, not flashy. Offense was non-existent.
Yeah, one of the big stats that stood out to me, obviously, defensive game, lots of punts. Well, Johnny Hecker for the Rams had 9 punts for 417 yards. So in the regular season as a whole, he had 43 punts, and he had 9 in the Super Bowl. 20% of his regular season punt total was equated in the Super Bowl.
That's crazy.
Yeah, for a Rams offense that is so high-flying, I mean, Johnny Hecker only doing 43 punts, that's less than 3 in a game on average. That's excellent in the regular season for him to do 9. Ridiculous. On the other side of the ball, New England's Ryan Allen only had 5 for 215, still a decent amount, not quite as astounding as Hecker. Time of possession, though, that was one of the stats I looked at last week. Both New England and LA possessed the ball for more than half the game. Obviously, they weren't both going to be able to do that unless it went to overtime. Final stats were New England had the ball for 33 minutes, 10 seconds, the Rams for 26:50. Pretty even, but
yeah,
still,
for the most part.
You can see the differential there of 7 minutes was what helped New England get their 10 extra points. You said you like big, flashy plays. New England had 4 sacks to LA's 1. That was a big point I made last week, how New England actually was ranked 30th in the regular season in sack total. LA was right around the middle. That didn't work out in this game, though. It was just a masterful game planning on Bill Belichick and the whole New England Patriots part there.
Yeah, you're right. And one play that I didn't mention that I thought was maybe one of the best defensive plays of the Super Bowl was Jason McCourty on Brandon Cooks in
absolutely.
The end zone. Brandon Cooks was wide open. McCourty made a break for it when he saw the ball come out, and he got there in the nick of time and broke up what would have been the Rams' only touchdown in the Super Bowl. Maybe a game saver?
Absolutely.
Not at the time, it's not necessarily, but looking back, I think it's easy to say that's a game saver.
Yeah, he sprinted about 20 yards right to the ball because there's a blow in coverage by the Patriots. They're 1 gaffe maybe on defense the entirety of the
right.
game. And Goff, just 2 seconds earlier, he has him for the touchdown, but he found him the same time that McCourty found him, gave him enough time to make the play. Rams obviously did not score a touchdown on that drive or any drive, so that was huge for them. And the Rams also, in the regular season, 421 yards on average of offense, 260 yards of offense in the Super Bowl. Just, they were stifled the entire game.
Yeah, they were, and especially in the first half. You said how you didn't think the Rams really were ever in the game, and it's because their first half was atrocious. I mean, they didn't have anything really to show for the first half, and you talked about the time of possession. I would say, guessing, the Rams probably had next to none in the first half. I think they had made less than a minute by the time the Patriots were through with their first two drives.
Yeah.
So just not a lot going there either. A couple other notes, and these are notes that I'm sure you've heard before that have been tossed around quite a few times in the last week. Brady is now the oldest quarterback to win a Super Bowl, passing Peyton Manning, who was 39. Brady is 41. He also now has the most Super Bowls of any player. He was in a tie. He now stands alone at six. Bill Belichick is the oldest head coach to have won a Super Bowl, and he is tied for the most championships, not Super Bowls, NFL championships as a head coach with George Halas and Curly Lambeau.
I have to shake my head at this. As a Steelers fan, it's really hard to hear all these stats read about them, but you do have to just sit, accept the greatness that is New England Patriots, Bill Belichick, and Tom Brady. Year in, year out, they find the way to get it done. He's 41. People don't play halfway through their 30s usually, and he doesn't look like he's taken a step back in any direction. Obviously not. Didn't do fantastic in the Super Bowl, but did well enough to get the job done for his team. Another interesting note, ratings for the Super Bowl. They hit a 10-year low. Only on CBS, it was 98.2 million. Some streams helped put that over 100 million, but below 100 million for the first time in 10 years. New Orleans was a big factor in this. They had a rating of 26.1. That means just about a quarter of all households in New Orleans were tuned into the Super Bowl. That's the lowest ever for New Orleans in history. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, you and I talked about that earlier, and I'm not surprised. I mean, put yourself in the shoes of a Saints fan. Why do you want to watch that? You're watching a Patriots team who's there every single year against the team that you feel like should be you. So I understand why they wouldn't want to watch that. And I'm glad you made the point about how fantastic the Patriots are, because people spend so much time hating on the Patriots, and some of that is because of how often their greatness is talked about, but there is a part of you that just wants to step back, I think, and kind of take in what you're seeing. Of course, there's a larger part that wants you to be done with the Patriots, as most people would say, but certainly one of the greatest franchises, one of the greatest dynasties ever. That's a little teaser. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But a fantastic performance for the Patriots. One more note on the Super Bowl commercials. Chris, did anything stand out to you?
All right, so I know I'm not going to be favored in this one, but there was one for Mint Mobile. I had never heard of the company, but the commercial was people drinking chunky milk.
That was funny.
I thought it was hilarious. I know most people thought it was gross, disgusting, whatever. I was just laughing the entire time. T-Mobile also had a great line of texting ones. I feel like most of us have already been in those shoes where you want to say something. Oh, that's not the right thing. Maybe this. Oh, that's not it either. Then the other person says what you're thinking anyway. Thought those were brilliant as well.
Yeah, T-Mobile was one I was going to say. That was my favorite. I think the idea of a Super Bowl commercial is to be memorable. And I think every year you get companies that try to string together a few. Bud Light tried to do it this year as well. I thought without any success, but T-Mobile did it to a T. I thought it was just fantastic. The commercials were funny, and I've seen them since, and they're still funny. So I thought T-Mobile stole the show.
The NFL's 100 commercial I thought was very well done as well.
Yes, that was a good one, too.
A lot of great players. Unfortunately, Goodell was in there, too. Don't worry about that. Focus on the great players they had. Some good action, too, them tackling each other all over the tables. I thought it was a great way to encapsulate the NFL's 100 years of history. So congrats to the NFL in that regard, at least.
I agree. That was another good one. So that wraps up the Super Bowl, but we're not done with the NFL season yet. Awards and yellow jackets, Chris. We've seen a new class of the Hall of Fame be announced. We've seen awards handed out. What do you got?
All right. So on the award front, we discussed last week or 2 weeks ago, rather, who we thought should win the awards. Most of the people we said were who ended up winning them. There really wasn't that much debate. Patrick Mahomes took away Offensive Player of the Year and MVP. Aaron Donald was Defensive Player of the Year. Darius Leonard was Defensive Rookie of the Year. Saquon Barkley was Offensive Rookie, which there was some debate between him and Baker Mayfield. That was really the only close debate, I thought. Matt Nagy, Coach of the Bears, was Coach of the Year. Walter Payton, Man of the Year. There wasn't any way for us to say who should win that. All 32 guys are well-deserving. Chris Long, though, ended up being the recipient of that award. So most of the awards really weren't that surprising, actually.
Yeah, good for Chris Long. That's an awesome award to win. As for the other ones, I mean, we have to throw it in the show, but I don't think there's a whole lot to talk about. For the most part, we picked all of these. You talked about Barkley and Mayfield. We both had Barkley. So for me, there's not a lot to talk about. You're right. That's a close race. You can make a case for either guy. I personally think the right guy won. You didn't think head coach was even close. I thought it was. I said on the show I thought Frank Reich should win. I didn't necessarily think he would, but I thought that he should win. I think if you can take a team from 1-5 and get them to the postseason, you're doing something right. But regardless, Matt Nagy is more than deserving taking a Bears team with next to no expectations, leading them to a 12-4 record and an NFC North title. So good for him there. But yeah, I don't think that there was too much surprising or too much noteworthy from the awards. I think it's pretty much as expected.
Yeah, I mean, middle of the season, you could have made an argument for a lot of different people. There was points where Jared Goff and Todd Gurley were talked about for MVP. Drew Brees was right up there for most of the season. But really, when you look at the season as a whole, the right people won the right awards. Everybody kind of pulled away in the second half who deserved to win. Some people had lesser second halves that, you know, clearly didn't really make the cut. So the people who deserved to win, I thought, were the clear champions. Also, kudos to Matt Nagy. Well, maybe not, but his defensive coordinator, Vic Fangio, is now the new head coach of, I believe, Denver.
Denver.
So first year as a head coach, he wins coach of the year, and he's already getting people stealing his lessers than him. So good for him to be challenging to see if they can do it again without the defense last year. But congratulations to all those award winners. Now on to the Yellow Jackets. Those are the Pro Football Hall of Fame inductees for 2019. I'm going to start by going over some of like the legends, the owners, the older people that many of us might not remember. I'm going to start with Pat Bowlen, and he was owner of the Denver Broncos from 1984 to 2014, led them to 7 Super Bowl appearances, 3 victories in those 7 games, and he has the highest win percentage, the Broncos do, have the highest win percentage of any team in the NFL since 1984. Unfortunately, he stepped down in 2014 due to complications to Alzheimer's, but the legendary factors he played into the Broncos franchise cannot be forgotten. Congratulations to him. Gil Brandt, longtime Dallas scout slash executive from 1960 to 1988. I didn't know anything about this guy until I read about him earlier today, actually. He revolutionized scouting, implemented the use of computers, expanded searches to Canada and Europe for players, and even looked in other sports such as basketball or track. Really, that was unheard of at that time, and he was one of the pioneers of that. Additionally, Johnny Robinson, he was a safety for the Kansas City Chiefs from 1960 to 1971, seven-time first-team All-AFL slash All-Pro, 3-time second team, and he's a member of the All-AFL team. AFL was around for about 10 years. They had a first and second team, you know, that fields all 11 stars on offense and defense. He was the guy chosen for safety, so congratulations to him finally making it in after all this time. Who you got from the more recent guys, Matt?
So we have a couple guys getting in on their first try. Champ Bailey, cornerback, spent some time with Denver. No Super Bowls for him, but he was a 12-time Pro Bowler. 52 career interceptions and part of the 2000s All-Decade team. Ed Reed, a safety for the Ravens primarily. 9-time Pro Bowler, won a Super Bowl with Baltimore. Led the league in interceptions 3 times. Leads all NFL players all time in interception return yards with 1,590. Quite the mark there for Ed Reed. 13 non-offensive touchdowns in his career, so pretty remarkable there. Tony Gonzalez is the first tight end to get in on his first time on the ballot. 14-time Pro Bowler, had 102 receptions in 2004, which is an incredible mark for a tight end. And he has 1,325 career receptions, second all-time. So a great number there. Who are the other two, Chris?
All right, so Ty Law was primarily a defensive back for the Patriots from 1995 to 2004, made 5 Pro Bowls, was a 2-time first-team All-Pro, led the league in interceptions twice, and was a 3-time Super Bowl champion with those Patriots. Kevin Mawai was an offensive lineman. He kind of traveled around the league pretty evenly. Started out in Seattle in 94, moved to the Jets in 98, and then moved to Tennessee in 2006, where he finished in 2009 as an 8-time Pro Bowler, 7-time first-team All-Pro. And from 1995 to 2004, he did not miss a single start. Started all 16 games every time in those seasons. Also, Tony Gonzalez only missed 2 starts in his career, so big kudos to them. Another stat on Ed Reed that you didn't point out, which is even more remarkable, that he actually broke his own record for longest interception return, which he currently holds. Previously, he held it with 106 yards. Later in his career, he had 107 yards, which still stands. So
I didn't come across that one. That's a good one.
Yeah, so he technically had 3 all-time NFL stats, but because he broke one of his own, he only holds 2 now. I'm going to say a lot of these guys aren't that surprising to me. If you look at most of them, Champ Bailey, he was easily the most lockdown corner of the 2000s in the AFC, all of NFL. Ed Reed is one of the top 5 safeties of all time. Tony Gonzalez, I think, is probably the top tight end of all time. I'm sure you can make some cases for some other people, but these guys really weren't that surprising. Ty Law had some great time in New England, was very heralded there too. So I think Kevin Y might be the only one that people were a little bit leery on. You know, there's a lot of other good offensive linemen, Alan Faneca and Steve Hutchinson come to mind, but clearly Kevin Y did deserve it. He also was the NFL PA representative for some time too, which he thinks accelerated his retiring. So needless to say, all these guys definitely deserving about all their accolades they've achieved.
Yeah, one thing about Kevin Mawai, 8 times in his career, his offense was top 5 in rushing, and he was on the offensive line for 13 1,000-yard running backs. So I think that speaks a lot to why
13.
It's a remarkable number. So I think that's probably a large part of why he got in. A lot of success there. And you talked about some of the older guys who got in. Johnny Robinson led the AFL and the NFL in interceptions once in his career, which obviously not many people can say, so I thought that was kind of a cool stat. And he played some offense too, I believe, in his early playing days.
He was a flanker.
Yeah, so that's interesting. Gil Brandt, you talked about revolutionizing scouting. I don't know if you mentioned it or not, but he also kind of started with the small colleges, going to small colleges to look for players. So just another thing there that he did differently. And Bolin for Denver, only 7 losing seasons in the entire time that he was the owner. And he's the only owner ever to rack up 300 wins in his first 30 seasons.
That's about an average of 10 wins a season, too. That's very nice there.
Yeah, so some really good numbers for the older guys that we might not be so familiar with.
One of the fun things I saw about Johnny Robinson, too, was he was actually drafted in the first round twice, once by the AFL and once by the NFL.
That's funny.
So this is a guy that clearly had the knack for playing safety. A lot of people wanted him. But needless to say, congratulations to all these recipients of their 2019 Hall of Fame induction. They will be inducted in Canton in the beginning of August, right before the wonderful Hall of Fame game. But
yeah.
The important part is them getting inducted, not the Hall of Fame game. Be interesting to see if some of these other guys might make it next year. Kevin Mawai might have started the chain of, okay, time to look more at offensive linemen getting in. You know, like I said, Faneca and Steve Hutchinson. Isaac Bruce, another guy on the finalist list that didn't quite make it in. He was a best receiver for the Rams for about 10 years, led the league several times in receiving, was clearly the best member of the greatest show on turf. So I wouldn't be surprised if he got in next year, but congratulations to the guys who did get in.
All right, so moving on, we're going to look at one final part of the NFL season. We're going to look specifically at the Pittsburgh Steelers. Earlier in our school year here, we did a Pirate season review, so we're going to do the same thing for the Steelers.
We got to go from good to bad like that.
Yeah. 9-6-1 for the Steelers this year, 2nd in the North, 7th in the AFC, so obviously they missed the playoffs. The offense was solid. They were 4th overall, 6th in scoring, 2nd in passing, 31st in rushing, unfortunately. 17th in penalties, which turned into the 3rd most penalty yards of any offense in the NFL. 28th in turnover margin at a negative 11. Let's start there.
Oh, man, it was rough to watch us. 9-6-1, I guess, is a good start, seeing how we started at 1-2-1. But also seeing how we were 7-2-1, you don't want to end up going 9-6-1. This was a very topsy-turvy team. Beginning of the season, looked like they had no idea who they were. Middle of the season, they looked like they could steamroll anybody on their way to the Super Bowl. And ended up missing the playoffs entirely. The offensive numbers are kind of surprising to me. Yes, we did have a fantastic offense. Ben did lead the league in passing. He racked up 5,129 yards, so us being 2nd in passing makes sense. 31st in rushing, though, that's rough. James Conner did have a good season, really his first year as the feature back for the Steelers. 973 yards on the ground, 12 touchdowns. Coupled that in with 55 catches for 497 yards and 1 touchdown. So he looked explosive out of the backfield. But there was just too many games where Ben was just throwing his arm out the entire time, hence why we finished 31st in rushing. I mean, he didn't need to attempt as many passes as he did, which also was a league-leading as well. It's just very bad that we look so good at times, and for us to come up so short is really disappointing.
What's frustrating for me is that James Conner is a Pro Bowl running back, and we had the worst run-to-pass ratio in the entire NFL. And we have one of the best offensive lines, so I just thought the offense didn't operate necessarily the way it should have. You hit on some numbers. I'll hit on a couple more. Juju Smith-Schuster had 111 catches for 1,426 yards and 7 touchdowns. Antonio Brown had 104 receptions for 1,297 yards and 15 touchdowns. Defensively, it was a little bit of a different story. 6th overall, which isn't bad. 16th in scoring, which is a little worse. 23rd in passing, 6th in rushing. The real kicker, though, no team was penalized more on the defensive side of the football than the Pittsburgh Steelers. Obviously, that led to the most penalty yards. One bright side, they were tied for first in the NFL in sacks. What do you make of the defense?
Well, the sacks, they led the league actually in 2017, I guess now 2 years in a row, seeing how they were tied for first. So getting to the quarterback has not been the issue for them. It's what happens if they don't get to the quarterback. The defense was shaky at times, gave up a lot of points. Chiefs, they gave up 42-2. Tampa Bay, they let get 27, which was more than – Tampa Bay had a good offense, but that was still more than they should have. There was a lot of times where the defense just couldn't make the stop they needed to. Most of those losses, when we lost those three in a row to the Chargers, the Broncos, the Raiders, there were times where we needed the defense to make the big play at the big time. They just didn't get it done. Being sixth overall in total defense, that's very good compared to how they had been looking the past few seasons. They definitely turned it around a lot. TJ Watt had a fantastic season, 68 tackles, 13 sacks, 6 forced fumbles. So really, he did fantastic the year before, but this might be more of a breakout year, kind of put him on the map of, okay, this guy's one of the best edge rushers in the league, as opposed to this is a solid JJ Watt younger brother. He's now his own player, so congratulations to him. But 16th in scoring, seeing how they're 6th in total defense, kind of doesn't sit well with me. There was a lot of times where in years past they were a bend, don't break. Well, this year apparently they were a break like your fingers when you crack them, because there was no stopping some of these teams going down the field. I don't think we really had that many interceptions either. I watched all 16 games, and it just didn't seem like there was times where we'd have 2 or 3 picks in a game where there's other teams that they get that kind of play from their defense. I just wanted to see a little bit more of that from them.
Joe Hayden was our team leader in interceptions. He had 2.
Yeah, that's rough.
He was the only player that had 2. Sean Davis had a nice season, 80 tackles, 1 interception, tied for 2nd on the team, I guess, in interceptions.
Yeah, woohoo.
TJ was kind of the star of the defense and kind of what made the defense relevant, really. I will say the offense put the defense in bad positions.
Absolutely.
I think the reason that you see the discrepancy between yards and scoring is because turnovers obviously give the other team the ball in a nice position to score without having to get so many yards. So I think that's probably where you see that. And, I mean, turnovers are kind of the story of the season. You can point to the imbalance of the offense or to the poor pass defense, whatever you want to, but a minus 11 turnover differential is not going to get it done. And whether that's the offense turning it over too often or the defense not being able to get it back or a little bit of both, it's hard to win when you can't keep the ball or you can't get the ball back. And that was kind of the issue that they had. Drama, of course, was also a headline.
Oh, my goodness.
Le'Veon Bell all season long, never ended up playing, but he was a discussion for at least the first half of the season, week in and week out. Antonio Brown, not so much during the season, but in week 17, he leaves the game, doesn't play in the game, and, of course, it's gone straight downhill for him and the Steelers since. We'll see what happens with those two guys, but certainly when you have those kind of distractions in the locker room, it's not going to bode well for your team. Looking ahead to next season, pick number 20 in the draft. No Mike Munchak next year, offensive line coach. One of the best offensive lines in football. Hopefully that stays as is, but we'll see. And the Killer Bees, I think, are in question. A couple years ago, that's what Pittsburgh was praised for. Ben, Boswell, Brown, and Bell. Well, Bell's probably on his way out. Brown's probably on his way out. And Boswell forgot how to kick. So what the Killer Bees will look like next year, it's hard to say.
Yeah, Boswell really was a Killer Bee, but for all the wrong reasons this season. He was 43 for 48 on extra points, so he missed 5 of them. And you talked about defense was put in some tough situations. He was 13 for 20 on field goals, so 7 times he missed field goals where the defense obviously had to make a play after the fact, which gives them a better field position generally than a regular kickoff would do. Boswell looked inconsistent, which was very surprising, seeing how he was a very solid kicker the past few seasons, really a diamond in the rough that we found following Sean Sweezum's injury a few years ago. We went through a few different kickers that season, finally settled upon Boswell, thought we had our kicker for the future, gave him a nice extension in the offseason, and he turns around and makes us look like we had no idea what we were doing with his kicker. He ended up being injured at the end of the season. I wonder if that was more than just the end of the season. Maybe it was psychological. Maybe he helped use that as an excuse. I don't know what the case was. Either way, he missed too many important kicks. Also, turnover margin, Ben had 16 interceptions. So when you have 34 touchdowns, that's good. But 16 interceptions on the other side of the ball, it's not good. And a lot of those were, the ball being overthrown and stuff too, things that shouldn't have happened when they did. It's not like it was a lot of tip drills or anything. It was just bad, ill-advised throws that Ben was making. Antonio Brown, once again, had a fantastic season. The 104 receptions, 1,297 yards, and 15 touchdowns. Those 15 touchdowns led the league. So there was no shortage of production for AB. I mean, he had just about as good a season as he's had the last 5 years with us. but somehow he just turned into such a drama queen, even going to the length to post on Instagram a picture of him photoshopped in a Niners jersey. It's really hard to see this team having the same kind of composition next year as they did this year. You mentioned losing Mike Munchak. That's huge. Great offensive line. I mean, he needs to be with his family. That's why he went to Denver. I don't give him any blame for leaving the Steelers. Obviously, he's not even leaving a good situation, really, with all the drama. So, no worries on him. But still, be interesting to see what they do going forward in the next year for how rocky it got towards the end of this season.
Yeah, a team with sky-high expectations going in. And I'd say at this point, they're a team that's left with more questions than answers. We'll see what happens with them next year. Obviously, we'll cover them in the offseason as we will with the NFL, but that's the end of the NFL season on the field and for us. Let's move into some other football now.
More football? How?
More football. The Alliance of American Football kicks off this weekend. It's a new football league, 8 teams in the league. It is professional football. Don't get anything confused with them, with the XFL. They are more like the NFL than anything. They're not trying to compete with the NFL. It's more of a developmental league where players who maybe are trying to get to the NFL or players who were once in the NFL can come to play to get another chance to grow a little bit more as football players. I'm excited about this, like really excited about this. It's more professional football. It's essentially minor league football in a way with no affiliation is essentially what it is. But their biggest selling point is that they're not different than the NFL. It's just a different time of year. The season's not as long. It's a 10-week season with 2 rounds of playoffs. I'm excited about this, Chris.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like an exciting time. So you said 8 teams, 4 in the East, 4 in the West. We have Atlanta, Birmingham, Memphis, and Orlando in the East. In the West, we have Arizona, Salt Lake, San Antonio, and San Diego. So a few of these areas have some professional football teams that might develop a fan base. Another few of these teams, however, Birmingham, San Antonio, they've been craving NFL football, I've heard, for a few years. Alabama's a really good football area, so for them to get a professional team, good for them. I like it that it's not marketing like the XFL. The XFL is trying to make all these rule changes be different or whatever. The Alliance of American Football, however, they're essentially it's the same rules. A few different rules that won't deteriorate from the game, I will mention right now, though. So there are no kickoffs or extra points. You just have to go for 2 on every possession, which, you know, it gives a little bit more excitement for people who might not be as, you know, interested in trying this. You'd be like, oh, okay, it's a little faster pace. I like it. Play clock is 35 seconds instead of 40 seconds. So once again, just a little bit faster to get the ball rolling a little bit more. The no kickoff thing, the team will either start with the ball at the 25 or the opposing team will have to have a 12-yard one down possession that they have to get 12 yards on or else the other team will get the ball. Unfortunately, that's different than onside. It's interesting. It's innovative. I don't know how well it'll work, but it's definitely a new concept. Another thing I really like that the NFL I really think is going to implement, they have a sky judge. The sky judge is just like any other referee on the field, except he is up in a booth. He can use any kind of technology to call or take away penalties missed or made by officials. So essentially, it is the hand of God reaching down onto the field from above and saying, no, no, you missed this. This wasn't right. Change this. I like it a lot. The NFL has talked about the pass interference rule being looked at. I think a sky judge like this is a perfect way to look at that.
That's brilliant. I love that. And I think what the AAF is doing especially well is they're comparing themselves to the NFL in the sense that this is football. This isn't the XFL showboating. That's right. This isn't the Canadian Football League. This isn't arena football. It's professional football like you see on an NFL football field. It sounds to me like they're taking what you could consider the NFL's weaknesses and making it their strength or making it their selling point, and I think that that's absolutely brilliant. You talked about the 8 teams. There are some names on these rosters that are familiar. For the Arizona Hotshots, their quarterback is Trevor Knight, a guy whose name you might remember from his college days and early NFL career. The Atlanta Legends, their quarterback is Aaron Murray. Offensive coordinator, Mike Vick. That's a household name that everyone knows, Mike Vick, especially in Atlanta. For the Birmingham Iron, quarterback is Blake Sims. Running back, Trent Richardson, getting another chance.
Hey, the Alabama duo right there.
That's right. Memphis Express, the quarterback is Zach Mettenberger, who spent some time in Tennessee after his LSU career. Head coach is Mike Singletary, Super Bowl champion, so some NFL ties there. Orlando Apollo's head coach, Steve Spurrier, another household name at head coach. Salt Lake Stallions, the head coach is Dennis Erickson. San Antonio Commanders head coach is Mike Riley. And for the San Diego Fleet, running back, Bishop Sankey. So some names across the board that at least gives you a familiar face to root for.
Yeah, and even in the front office, there's a lot more familiar faces you might see. So Charlie Ebersole and Bill Polian, their co-founders. Bill Polian had a large influence in the NFL in his time as an executive. And then a lot of other former players now have positions as well. Troy Polamalu is the head of player relations. Hines Ward is the player relations executive. Jared Allen is a player relations executive and investor. Justin Tuck is a member of player engagements and board of advisors. So these are four names that if you saw football at any time 10 years ago for any solid duration, Hines Ward, Polamalu played for the Steelers. Justin Tuck bounced around to with the different teams, was on the Giants as well. Jared Allen was with the Vikings for several years. These are all people that you know, like, hey, I like this guy. A lot of people like Polamalu and Hines Ward in Pittsburgh, I know. Might give them a little bit more influence to help watch the game. And if they want to, where can they watch these games, Matt?
So the very first game is going to kick off on Saturday at 8 o'clock. It's going to be on CBS, major network, easy to watch. They're going to have some other games throughout the season on CBSSN, CBS Sports Network. TNT is going to have one regular season game and one postseason game, and the NFL Network is going to carry two games per week. So certainly not difficult to find. You might have to look just a little bit, but it's there. If you want to watch football throughout the NFL offseason, the AAF is there. I'm excited, Chris. I can't wait to watch this.
I cannot wait either. It should be a rip-roaring of a good time. For now, we are going to take a quick break, but coming up, we have some whirlwind of NHL and NBA trade news and signings, so please stay tuned for that.
Sliding my
Welcome back to Sports Takeover, Matt and Chris. We're going to switch to the NHL and NBA here. A lot of moves going on, Chris. Let's start in the National Hockey League. Go ahead.
All right, so there's a lot of trades, but we're going to start with some signings. Big one in Toronto, Austin Matthews, best player on their team, signed a five-year, $58 million extension. That's good for an average annual value of $11.6 million per year. Huge for him. Kind of interesting that it's only 5 years, though. You kind of see longer-term players like him getting 7-8-year deals. So for the fact that it's only five, interesting to see where he's going to go after those years. You got another one, too?
Yeah, Phoenix Copley, backup goaltender for the Washington Capitals, signed a three-year extension for $3.3 million. He's 10-5-3 on the season with a .298 goals against average and a .903 save percentage. 27 years old, so a little old to be this early in his NHL career, but he's certainly been solid for the Capitals this year. A very reasonable contract for your backup goalie. I thought it was a good signing.
All right, and so with those signings said, time to move into the more fun part, the trade front. Last week, huge news in Pittsburgh. We made a trade with the Florida Panthers where Pittsburgh received Nick Bjugstad and Jared McCann, both centers, in exchange for Derek Brassard, Riley Sheahan, a second rounder, and a fourth rounder. Huge movements there, lots of picks, lots of players. What are your thoughts on that, Matt?
So Derek Brassard was a player who kind of disappointed in his time in Pittsburgh, a first or second line center who never really fit into the role of third line center. Understandably, that's a hard role to fill. Jordan Staal filled it very well in his time here in Pittsburgh.
Nick Bonino, too?
Yeah, Nick Bonino, but just not the role for Brassard. He had 15 points in 40 games this year. My favorite part about this trade for the Penguins is the contracts, because Brassard and Sheahan go out, both guys who are going to be unrestricted free agents come this summer. Nick Bjugstad has 2 years left on his contract, and McCann will be a restricted free agent at the end of the year. So I think for that reason, it's beneficial, and that somewhat justifies the picks that go the other way. Bjugstad had 13 points in 33 games before coming over. McCann had 18 points in 47 games. Both of those guys are natural centers. So we'll see Bjugstad probably take Brassard's place and McCann kind of take Sheahan's place. So it makes sense there. Penguins also got younger. Brassard is 31, Sheahan is 27. The guys are getting back. Bjugstad is 26 and McCann is 22. So some youth there. Some guys who aren't necessarily better hockey players, but who should fit their roles better for Pittsburgh. For Florida, you're getting a guy in Derek Brassard who you hope can do in Florida what he couldn't do in Pittsburgh. Now, what Florida's game plan is in the short term versus the long term, I think remains to be seen. Like I said, both their contracts expire at the end of the season. And maybe you wait and see. I've heard reports that they have some big games coming up in the next 3 weeks. They're going to see how it plays out. And maybe Brassard won't even be a Florida Panther by the end of the season. Interesting to see there. Kind of gives Florida some options. The draft picks are always good as well. So I think a good trade for both sides.
Yeah, I like the Penguins getting Bjugstad. He has a right-handed 6'6" forward, so
he definitely is a huge
yeah,
man.
Yeah, he has all the size that we don't have right now on offense. Right-handed is important to me for the faceoff circle. We don't have any right-handed shots. I like that matchup a lot. McCann is younger. They seem to favor him a lot, you know, a lot of potential. You said you liked it because we got rid of them. We probably weren't going to re-sign them in the offseason. Well, Florida likes it even better because they freed up contract space, because I don't think they're going to sign them in the offseason. I saw they were going to make a run at Artemi Panarin and Sergei Bobrovsky of the Blue Jackets, who are both free agents coming
this offseason.
Boy, would
those be some big pickups.
Right, yeah, and a team that already has Alexander Barkov and Jonathan Huberdeau, some more offensive firepower and solid goaltending, too, because face facts.
Vincent Trocheck.
Yeah, even better.
Aaron Ekblad on the back end.
A lot of good players on this team. They just don't have the missing links.
They're right there.
We like them, I think, a lot more than most people in the NHL.
I think
do.
So, too. I think at times we like them more than they like them, but I really feel like they're only a piece or two away.
Yeah, I mean, Roberto Luongo is getting older. Let's face facts. He doesn't have much longer in the league. So going after a guy like Bobrovsky with all this cap space, they're going to get really big for them. So I think it's good for both ways. I don't necessarily like all the picks that Pittsburgh is giving up, because when we acquired Brassard last year, we gave up a first-round pick and Philip Gustafson, who was our best goalie prospect in minor league system. So kind of a lot of picks have been involved with trading Derek Brassard. Not really a lot coming to us, but sometimes you got to accept the fact that, hey, this guy just didn't work out with us, wasn't the right fit for our scheme. I read an article from Brassard today, said no ill will towards anybody on the Penguins or anything, just didn't work out. So hopefully he has a better career with Florida or wherever else they may send him. Moving into the Western Conference, Nashville made two moves today. The first is acquiring centerman Brian Boyle from the Devils in exchange for a second-round pick. He also got Cody McLeod from the Rangers for a seventh-round pick. McLeod's not that important, but Brian Boyle, definitely a big-time player for them, can be a really good offensive power forward, had great success with Tampa Bay a few years ago when they made the cup, and then when they came up short in the Eastern Conference Final. I like this move a lot for Nashville.
Yeah, McLeod's pretty irrelevant. Brian Boyle's a good pickup, especially with Austin Watson being suspended for the Predators. Brian Boyle has 19 points in 47 games, 34-year-old unrestricted free agent, so it's certainly a rental, or at least it appears it could be a rental, but for a team like Nashville, I think you can afford to do that. A second-round pick doesn't break the bank. I think it's a good move for an experienced guy. One other note in the NHL, not any type of transaction, but Alex Ovechkin now has the most points by a Russian player. He passed Sergei Fedorov, I believe, just last night. So congratulations to Alex Ovechkin. That's a pretty huge milestone.
Yeah, it's another Bill Belichick type situation. Man, I don't really care for Alex Ovechkin, but you can't deny the fact that he is one of the greats we're witnessing play right now.
He's got the best shot of our generation.
Absolutely. Obviously the best Russian-born player of all time now, seeing how he has passed Sergei Fedorov. So congratulations to him. Moving into the NBA, their trade deadline is tomorrow, February 7th. But the ball is already rolling for many of these teams. The first one started at the end of last week, huge between the Knicks and the Mavericks. So the Knicks met with their best player, Kristaps Porzingis, about the direction of the team. Apparently the meeting was only 5 minutes. That 5 minutes was enough for the Knicks to decide, he's not the direction we want to go with our team if he's not invested in us. So they sent Porzingis, Tim Hardaway Jr., Courtney Lee, and Trey Burke to the Mavericks in exchange for DeAndre Jordan, Dennis Smith, Wesley Matthews, and two future first-round picks. So the Knicks got some old guys in Jordan and Matthews. Dennis Smith Jr., that's a guy the Knicks could have drafted 2 years ago. Instead, they let him fall to one pick below, which the Mavericks took him at, and now they're wasting all these people to get him back in return. I think this is a poor trade for the Knicks, good for Dallas. You now have Luka Doncic with Kristaps Porzingis for the next 10, 15 years, presumably. I like Trey Burke at Michigan. He was pretty good there. Courtney Lee and Tim Hardaway are some other good role-playing guards. I think this is a great move for Dallas.
Yeah, I think so too. And Porzingis is such a unique player. He's a young guy, and the man is 7'3". He's the tallest player in the NBA. And of
unicorn.
Course, and of course, the height doesn't mean everything, but the man is 7'3", Chris. It's insane. He hasn't played all season, so in the immediate future, it's not going to impact the Knicks, but in the long term, I certainly think it will. He's a guy that Knicks fans didn't seem overly happy with when they drafted him, quickly grew to like him, now he's gone. Things just happen so quickly in the NBA. Like you said, the meeting was 5 minutes. It was a surprising move to me. I think it was a surprising move to most.
Knicks fans especially.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. I think it's a good move for Dallas. Another more minor trade, Rodney Hood going from Cleveland to Portland for Wade Baldwin and Nick Stauskas.
Yeah, those are two guys that don't mean anything to me when I think about Portland. Rodney Hood, though, is a guy, perimeter shooter, good three-point arsenal, can help Portland out a lot. They rank 7th in three-point percentage, but are only 20th in three-point field goals made. So clearly there is some lacking there, and adding Rodney Hood is a good move for them. Helps them out in the Western Conference that is highly competitive right now. Another slightly smaller move, the Lakers acquired Reggie Bullock from the Detroit Pistons in exchange for, oh boy, bear with me here, Svi Mykhailiuk. I'm sorry to him.
I'll give it to you, sure.
And
close
a
enough.
Future second rounder. Good for the Lakers. They need some more guard depth of Lonzo Ball being out longer term. Bullock has done well with the Pistons this year. Good for them. Any thoughts in there, too? Or?
It's good to get players when they're trying to ship the rest of them to New Orleans for Anthony Davis.
Absolutely.
Tobias Harris is on his way from the Clippers to the Philadelphia 76ers to
Huge.
Be part of a new Big Four that the 76ers are trying to put together and keep long-term. Harris was arguably the best player for the Clippers this season, only 26 years old. Certainly could be a corner piece for the 76ers moving forward. Certainly makes them, I think, one of the top contenders in the East, probably, along with the Raptors.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's a great move for them. A lot of people moving back and forth, not necessarily any guys that make a huge impact. Some guys who are only averaging maybe 11 minutes a game, somewhere around 7 points per game. Upper echelons, maybe 9 points per game. There's really just not a lot going back either way. Tobias Harris is the big piece.
Yeah, Harris is having a career year. He's averaging 20.9 points per game, best in his career, 7.9 rebounds a game, which is second best in his career. He really is one of the better players on the Clippers this year, a guy that you really haven't heard that much about. He's been a very solid player in his career, but never one like the pinnacle players. This year, certainly a breakout season for them. Sixers also sent 2 firsts and 2 seconds in exchange for this to the Clippers. But the Sixers don't need to worry about draft picks. They last 3-4 years, they've been stockpiling draft picks. That's why they've built the team that they have right now. So they can afford to send these guys out when they are in a prime position to win now. Their odds to win the Eastern Conference actually doubled from after acquiring this trade. I mean, their starting five now is Ben Simmons, J.J. Redick, Tobias Harris, Joel Embiid, and who am I forgetting, Matt? Do you know who I'm thinking of?
Did you say Simmons?
I think I did. I don't know. Someone else.
Jimmy Butler.
Jimmy Butler. Yeah, there we go. Even a bigger trade forgot about earlier this year. Yeah. So huge starting five for Philly. Really is going to help them compete with Milwaukee, Boston, and Toronto in the East, which, as we said before, is up for grabs. I like this move a lot.
I do too. And some breaking news in the last hour.
Dun, dun, dun.
The Wizards send Otto Porter Jr. to the Bulls for Bobby Portis, Jabari Parker, and a 2023 second-round draft pick. Even more recent is a three-team trade. Amon Shumpert is headed to the Rockets. The Kings are going to get Alec Burks and a second-round pick. The Cleveland Cavaliers are getting Brandon Knight and Marquise Chris, along with a first-round pick. So a lot of movement here as we approach the deadline.
Yeah, good move for the Wizards, seeing how John Wall, unfortunately, will be out even longer than they had expected. In January, he had his heel surgery on his left heel, which was going to keep him out for the rest of this year. But he said, hold on, I don't want to be out for just this year. I want to be out for 12 months. So earlier this week, he slipped and fell in his home and ruptured his left Achilles. So his left foot is essentially shot. John Wall was one of the premier point guards in the league. This is bad for Washington. We both thought that Washington was going to be a playoff team, maybe even division-winning team this year. But for how bad that John Wall's foot is now affecting his career, you have to wonder what the move is for them. Getting all these players back from Chicago certainly helps a bit, but it's tough.
Yeah, and he's had some injury issues, specifically with his knees over the last few years. So hopefully a speedy recovery to John Wall. Time to move on to a new segment that we call Top Takeover.
It's fun.
Where we are going to rank a top five different things every time we do the segment. This time, obviously, dynasty is a word being thrown around with the New England Patriots. So we are going to rank our top five dynasties in professional sports all time. Chris, lead us off.
All right, starting at number five, I'm going to start in the NFL. I have the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 1970s. They won four Super Bowls from 1974 to 1979, went back-to-back twice in that span, went 4-0 in those Super Bowls, did not lose one with that team. One of the best defenses of all time in the NFL, a steel curtain. Terry Bradshaw is a Hall of Famer. Great plays made by Lynn Swan. Definitely one of the better NFL franchises. Great in the 70s, so I'm going to go with them at number five.
Very interesting. My number five is going to come from the National Basketball Association, the San Antonio Spurs.
I love the Spurs.
From 1998 to 2014. So this is a team that isn't necessarily as dominant as some dynasties are, but the longevity in the salary cap era is hard to argue with. 15 playoff appearances, 11 division titles, 9 trips to the Western Conference Finals, 6 Western Conference titles, 5 NBA championships. Again, not the dominant team that you might think of with some dynasties, but the longevity in the salary cap era I just think is incredible. The guys that stayed there throughout the entire time. Greg Popovich is a fantastic coach.
Best in the NBA.
Yeah, I think the San Antonio Spurs are tough to argue with, I think.
One of my favorite things about the Spurs is they're my favorite NBA team, so I'm a little bit biased here. They didn't ever defend any of their titles either. They always had gap years in between them all.
Yeah.
There was basically between them and the Lakers in the West for a lot of those years. Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, Monty Ginobili, part of many of those teams, all spearheaded by Pop. Great choice at number five. I like it a lot. Moving on to number four, I'm going to move into the MLB, and I'm going to go to the New York Yankees, specifically the Yankees at the end of last century. They won 4 World Series titles from 1996 to 2000, including 3 in a row, and they had 6 AL pennants from 1996 to 2003. They were really just a dominant force in baseball at the turn of the century, had a few World Series that got away from them against Arizona and Florida, but you can't deny the greatness that was 3 years in a row and 4 over that span, so I'm going to have the Yankees at my number four.
I'm going to take a New York team, but it's not the Yankees, and it's definitely not the Mets. It's the New York Islanders from 1980 to 1983. 4 Stanley Cups in 4 years for the New York Islanders. 5 straight conference titles, 19 straight playoff series that they won, which is unmatched not only in the NHL, but in all professional sports. It's an incredible mark. It's much shorter term than a lot of dynasties, and this is after I say that the Spurs are good because of their longevity.
Yeah.
But to be able to do it 4 times in a row is unmatched. The Canadians have done it a few times in their history, but the Canadians have done it with fewer teams in the league.
Fewer playoff series as well each of those years.
That's true. The Islanders towards the end had Gretzky and the Oilers to contend with, so Four cups in 4 years is tough to argue with for the New York Islanders, so they're my number four.
Okay, moving ahead to number three. I'm going to change up sports drastically here. I'm going to go to NASCAR, actually.
Whoa!
Yeah, you probably didn't see this one coming. Jimmy Johnson is still considered one of the most dominant drivers, at least I've ever seen. From 2006 to 2016, he won seven titles in the Sprint Cup Series, which was the most of anybody, and five of those were in a row. It kind of got boring as a fan of NASCAR to watch the end of last decade because 5 years in a row, it was just, there's Jimmy Johnson again winning the title. You kind of thought it was over after he won those five, but in 2013 and 2016, he decides to throw in two more just because. So he has seven titles. Incredible stuff from him. And for those of you who don't know, NASCAR has 40 to 43 field drivers. About 20 of them are definitely considered for the championship every year. So the fact that he can do it, it's a team sport in NASCAR, don't get me wrong. Dynasties are considered team sports. Well, him and his team, Chad Knaus, was his crew chief all those years. So I have Jimmy Johnson at number three.
That's a very unique one, but that's a really good one. Mm-hmm. I like Jimmy Johnson. Great success. That's a really good pick. My number three is going to stay in the NHL, and I'm going to go with the Montreal Canadiens. And I just talked about them briefly. And the Canadiens have a lot of great stretches in their history. I'm going with one of their more recent ones from 1970 to 1979. They were, I think, 21 teams in the NHL at this point. I believe. I could be wrong on that, but I believe. Regardless, it's more than the six that they beat consistently early in their history. So, to me, this one's a little bit more relevant. They had seven first-place finishes, went to six finals, and won six cups over the course of 9 years. There was a four in a row in there. They had the best record of any team in modern NHL history. In the 1976-77 season, they went 60-8-12. For a record that still stands today of 132 points, which is just unbelievable. Their win percentage was better than 600 in each of those 9 seasons. So if you want to talk about a team that was dominant, they won 6 cups in 9 years. But if you put that aside, they're just all around fantastic. The whole way through regular season, postseason, all 9 years, they were the team to beat. I just think that that's incredible. And that's a textbook dynasty. That's why they're my number three.
Man, the NHL is really favoring heavily with both of us because at number two, I do also have an NHL team. I had a really tough time choosing between two. You mentioned the Islanders before, so I won't mention them again. I had them right up there with the Edmonton Oilers.
That's another good one.
Of the 1980s, who were the ones that ended up dethroning the Islanders. So in 1983 Stanley Cup, the Oilers lost to the Islanders. Rematch the following season is what started the Oilers dynasty. They had five titles in the span of 7 years from 1984 to 1990, mostly led by Wayne Gretzky. Six appearances in those time span too. So the 80s were just dominated by the Islanders in the front half, the Oilers in the second half. Then it kind of got a little more rambunctious in the 90s with more teams getting in. But the 80s, it was just Islanders and Oilers. So I had them tied at my number two.
Yeah, and then right before that was the Canadiens. So it was just the passing of the torch over the course of 20 years. It's really interesting to look back on. That's a great pick, and that's a team that I think is also very difficult to argue with. I would say that that was one of my honorable mentions that I didn't put in my top five, but that certainly could have been deserving. At number two, I'm going to go to the NBA and the Chicago Bulls from 1990 to 1998. Six division titles. Five times they finished the regular season first in the East. Six Eastern Conference titles and six NBA titles. That's two three-peats. The playoffs, they made the playoffs each year, 94, 95. They did not have Michael Jordan.
Baseball called his name.
That's right. So the outcomes weren't as favorable for them, but even still over this course, their worst record was 47-35 in one of the years without MJ. Still pretty fantastic. In 95, 96, I like the records, Chris. I talked about the one that the Canadians held. This one has since been broken by the Golden State Warriors, but 72-10, second best regular season record of all time. Difference between them and the Warriors is they capped it off with a championship to arguably be the best season of all time. Just unbelievable players on that team. Obviously, Michael Jordan's the headliner, but to three-peat once is remarkable. To do it twice is crazy, and to do it in a span of 8 years is just unbelievable. I'd say that's what you're holding everyone up to, at least in the NBA. So the Chicago Bulls of the 90s are my number two.
That's funny you mentioned them at number two because they are my number one. You can't argue against it. They went 6-6 in their NBA Finals appearances. That's ridiculous. Teams you would expect to lose at that point, they didn't. MJ even took a year off to go try playing baseball, ended up coming back to win three more titles because I guess he was still thirsty for more. Just remarkable by the Bulls. They are my number one best NBA team in the 90s and by far.
My number one dynasty is not going to be popular, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this after I talk about it a little bit, but I'm going with the New England Patriots.
Boo.
Although it really pains me to do so, 2001 to now, the Patriots have just been unbelievable. 16 division titles, 13 AFC championship games, 9 AFC championships, and 6 Super Bowl victories. They missed the playoffs twice, in 2002 when their record was 9-7, and in 2008 when they were 11-5 without Tom Brady. 9-7 is their only season over this course without 10 wins. 16-0 regular season in 2007 came up short of the Super Bowl, but regardless, a perfect regular season. Longest gap without a Super Bowl appearance since 2001, 3 years between their losses to the Giants. This is just a team that you haven't been able to count out since Tom Brady took over. People are sick of seeing them. I'm sick of seeing them. I'm sick of talking about them. But for me, I couldn't not put this list together and put them on it. I'm curious to hear why they weren't on yours.
So the interesting thing about them is you like the longevity part. I really think this is two different dynasties, however. The losses to the Giants in the middle of that span, I think, broke them up. Because the Patriots team that won 3 and 4 years, that was fantastic. You know, I thought about putting them in there. The Steelers winning 4 in a row, or two sets of two, I thought was a little bit better than them. But that team, there was people like Teddy Bruschi, Deion Branch, Tom Brady. You know, obviously Brady is still there, but that is not at all similar to the team that we have seen won 3 of the last 5 years. It's a whole different team now. Coaches have changed drastically. I mean, half the players that were playing for the Rams in their most recent Super Bowl were still in middle school or elementary school whenever Tom Brady first started doing this. So the only reason I didn't include them was because I just think the span in the middle. Had they beat the Giants one of those 2 years, I think you can make an argument for them being one continuous one. But I just think the gap from 2004 to 2014, the 10 years in the middle kind of is a little bit too long, in my opinion, for it to be one continuous dynasty. I had them as an honorable mention because it is very close still, because it's been Belichick and Brady all those years, but I just didn't want to include them for that reason, though.
That's a reasonable argument. I would say that they never dropped off in the middle, and for me, that's why I think that it's one continuous dynasty. You're right, the 3 and 4 years and then the 3 more recent, they are very separate, they are very different, but in the middle, they were in the playoffs every year, they were winning their division every year, they were getting byes in the playoffs more often than not. They did go to 2 Super Bowls in between, and dynasties are measured by winning Super Bowls, but I certainly think in your off years being there or being close, their dominance in their division, their dominance in the AFC, or at least getting to the AFC championship game, for me, is just too much to argue against, and I certainly see your point. For me, it's one dynasty, and for me, it's the greatest dynasty.
Yeah, I just see, like, the core group of players on those first 3 Super Bowl teams, there was very little to, if any, overlap. I think Tom Brady might be really the only overlap between those 3 and the most recent 3. So
him and Bill.
You really, in my opinion, dynasties are, you know, essentially the same core group of players. Obviously, players change every year, but if you look at those 4 Islander teams, I don't know specific numbers, but I would be willing to bet that on those 4 Islander teams, more than half the team was made up in all 4 of those years, too. So when you look at dynasties, I like to see the same core over that same time span. Another reason why I didn't include the Spurs, it was kind of just too long in my opinion. But certainly a storied dynasty, I think I'll probably have to include them in this list if they win again in the next 3 years, which I'd be surprised if they didn't at this point, honestly.
Very fair. Great discussion to be continued another day. Right now, we're going to conclude Top Takeover and go to quick picks, and we are going to make them quick, Chris. Hurricanes at Sabres. I'm going to take the Sabres. They're in the middle of a homestand, tied in the standings. Both have been kind of average since the All-Star game. I'll take the home team, Buffalo.
I'm going to go with Carolina in this one. They look fantastic in their 4-0 shutout victory of the Penguins last night. They are a team that is right there on the edge, trying to get in the playoffs. Look for them to make noise. Getting over the Sabres hurdle is one of those. Another NHL game, we have the Penguins traveling to Tampa Bay. I think Tampa is going to avenge the loss they had to the Penguins last week. Penguins have looked rough. A lot of line changes. Matt Murray is now day-to-day, too, so who knows if they'll even play that game. I'm going to go with Tampa.
I'm with you for the same reasons. I'm going with the Lightning. Pittsburgh hasn't been great. Pittsburgh beat them last time at home. I'll take Tampa. Ducks at Flyers. I'm taking the Flyers. It's real simple. The Flyers are on an 8-game winning streak. They're good. The Ducks have lost 17 of their last 19. They're bad. Flyers.
For that exact reason, I'm going to go with the Ducks. Winning streaks have to end somewhere. The Ducks losing streak has to end somewhere. This is the perfect game for the Ducks to beat the Flyers for no other reason other than just because I'm going to go with the Ducks. Moving into the NBA, a matchup of the 2010 NBA Finals. Los Angeles Lakers traveling to Boston to face the Celtics. The Lakers are a mess right now trying to figure out who's going to stay and who's going to go with the Anthony Davis rumors. Celtics, however, they seem to be firmly knowing who they are. I'm going to go with Boston.
Celtics are on a 5-game winning streak. The Lakers are in the middle of a six-game road trip. I'll take the Boston Celtics. Thunder at Rockets, I'm going to take the Thunder. They have more points per game on average. Harden leads that Rockets team. If he falls out of this game, it's going to be tough for them to keep up. No Clint Capella, I'm going to take the Thunder.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the Thunder as well. You have two factors on that team, Russell Westbrook and Paul George. You have one factor on the Rockets, James Harden, two beats one. Thunder beat Rockets. Also in the NBA, we have Washington Wizards playing against Detroit Pistons. Kind of an interesting matchup. Detroit just got rid of one of their guards. I think it's going to spearhead them to get a little bit more revenge. Washington's kind of down in the dumps with Wall being injured for longer term now. I'm going to go with Detroit.
I'll take the Pistons as well. Detroit is in the middle of a homestand. Washington's got one win in their last five games. The Pistons sound good to me. Finally, women's college basketball, number 3 Oregon at number 11 Stanford. I'm going to take Oregon. They've got one loss on the season to go with 21 wins. Stanford has lost two of their three losses have come in their last four games. I'm going to take Oregon.
I'm going to go with Oregon as well. You mentioned it. Stanford has been losing a little bit too much lately for my liking. Oregon is ranked number 3 with one loss for a reason. I'm going to go with Oregon. Was that fast enough for you all? That was fast enough for me, I think.
That was pretty fast, and that is more than enough time for us tonight. Thanks to everybody for tuning in here on Army Radio. Sports Takeover with Matt and Chris, same time next week. We'll see you then.